Can faith and reason work together, or are they somehow mutually exclusive? What role do facts and evidence play when it comes to the Christian faith? This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and on behalf of Dr. Craig, I want to welcome you to this discussion as Dr. Craig examines apologetics, reason, faith, and philosophy. Today, we are examining some of the evidence for the existence of God.
Dr. Craig, when we are presenting reasons for why we believe, what often comes up is, does God exist? That would be the most basic question, wouldn't it?
Right. That's fundamental. One of the pillars of the Christian world and life view is that it holds to theism, and that's the belief that God exists.
What I would want to do in our time together here is kind of do an overview of the evidence. And in future programs, we will get more specific on these lines of evidence for God's existence. First thing I would want to ask you as we are looking at an overview of the evidence, a lot of people take offering evidence for God's existence to mean that we attempt to prove God's existence 100%. Is that what we're trying to do?
No, I think there are few things that we can prove with 100% certainty. Rather, what we try to do is to construct an argument for a conclusion that is based upon premises or steps, each of which is more plausible than its negation, and which together logically imply the conclusion. And if you can do that, then you have a good argument.
So it's not like we're trying to prove it 100%, but we're trying to offer proofs for God's existence.
Proofs in the sense in which the philosopher uses that term. A proof in a philosophical sense is a series of statements which serve as premises from which a conclusion can be drawn based on the rules of logic. And those premises don't need to be known with 100% certainty. Maybe they'll just appear slightly more plausible than not, or perhaps they'll have a great deal of plausibility. But nevertheless, if we have more reason to believe the premises than their negations, and together these premises imply by the rules of logic a conclusion, then we can say that that conclusion is proved by this argument. But it doesn't require anything like 100% certainty.
Now, let's illustrate for our audience what we mean by premises. If I were to illustrate 3 points, one, things which begin to exist have a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. Three, therefore, the universe had a cause.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those first two, number one and two, would be premises, and the third one would be the conclusion.
That's right.
Given that those two premises are true.
That's right. And the conclusion in this case does follow logically from the two premises according to the rules of logic. And so if those two premises are in fact true, it follows that you have proved the conclusion to be true. And that doesn't mean that you have 100% certainty that the conclusion is true. You don't have to have 100% certainty the premises are true. Nevertheless, if those premises are true and the argument is constructed, as you said, then they prove the conclusion in the sense that the conclusion follows by the rules of logic.
I think we would all do well to brush up on this area. It's fun. It's fascinating. It helps our thinking skills. It helps us articulate what we believe.
Yes. Absolutely.
Now, let's look at an overview then of the evidence for the existence of God. What would you give us as a general overview of the evidence for God's existence?
Well, I think there are lots of good reasons to believe that God exists. The Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga laid out a few years ago in a paper he presented at the Wheaton Philosophy Conference 24 or so arguments for God's existence. And it was a tour de force listening to the creative sorts of arguments that Plantinga offered for the conclusion that God exists. In my own work, principally in the debates that I do on the existence of God on university campuses, I've chosen to focus on about 6 arguments for the existence of God that I think are sound. The first one would be the argument from contingency. This would be an argument for an explanation of why the universe exists. The second would be an argument from the beginning of the universe, a cosmological argument, which would argue that the beginning of the universe had to have a transcendent cause. The third argument would be the argument from design or for design based on the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. The fourth argument would be a moral argument that God is the best explanation for why objective moral values and duties exist. The fifth argument would be an argument, in effect, from miracles, that is to say, God is the best explanation for the historical facts concerning the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And then the final argument isn't really an argument. It's the claim that you can know God exists wholly apart from arguments through an immediate experience of God.
Fascinating. Now, each one of these we could talk about all day, but let's look briefly at a few of these. And let's look at the first one, contingency, the argument from contingency. If something is contingent, what do we mean by that?
We mean that it doesn't have to exist, that it could not exist. It's possible for it not to be. So something that's contingent would be something that happens to exist, but it doesn't have to exist, like people and planets and tables and chairs and stars and so forth.
I am a contingent being.
Right. You're dependent upon your parents for your existence.
And they're dependent on theirs, and they're dependent on theirs. And so, so it's a dependence. Now, if something were non-contingent, then it would be independent?
Yes, it would be an independently existing reality. And in particular, it would be a necessary being. It would be something whose non-existence is impossible, something which must exist, a being which cannot not exist.
That's fascinating. It really is. So the universe is contingent?
Well, the way I would put the argument is this. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in some external cause. Second premise would be that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. And the third premise is the universe exists. Well, now, from the first and the third premise, anything that exists has an explanation of its existence, and the universe exists, it follows that the universe has an explanation of its existence. And from that premise and the second premise, that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God, it follows that the explanation of the existence of the universe is God.
You used another word earlier, transcendent, that the universe has a transcendent cause. And what do we mean by the word transcendent?
Well, what I mean here is that the cause of the universe is not part of the universe. The opposite of being transcendent is being immanent. And if something is immanent, that means it's within something. That's immanent, spelled immanent, not immi, as in an imminent event, which means a pending event or something about to happen. This is immanent with an A, and that means it's within something. But transcendent would be something that doesn't exist as a part of the universe or within the universe. It's beyond the universe.
The second one that you mentioned is the beginning of the universe. Mm-hmm. Big Bang cosmology, that is, the Big Bang Theory, has really pointed in this direction, hasn't it?
This argument, which is a very ancient argument, goes back to within a couple hundred years after Christ, has received enormous empirical support because of Big Bang cosmology during the 20th century. This argument basically says whatever begins to exist has a cause. Second premise is that the universe began to exist, and that is supported by the best astrophysical evidence today. According to the Big Bang Theory, the universe is not eternal in the past, but came into being at some time in the finite past, and therefore the universe began to exist, from which it follows that the universe has a cause. And this will, of course, have to be a transcendent cause that is beyond the universe.
A lot of people try to get around this by saying that we have examples, perhaps, of something coming into existence uncaused, popping into existence without a cause.
I've been surprised by this, Kevin. Frankly, when I first worked on this argument at the University of Birmingham doing my doctoral dissertation there, I expected that the premise that the atheists would go after would be the second premise, that the universe began to exist. That seemed to me to be the more controversial. But the first premise, that whatever begins to exist has a cause, seems to me to be just obviously true. It's basically saying something can't come out of nothing. And surely if there's anything that is obvious, it would be that out of nothing, nothing comes, that something can't come from nothing. But you're right in saying that atheists, when confronted with the evidence for the beginning of the universe, are forced to attack and deny that first premise instead, which seems so obviously true. And so they have to say, well, the universe just popped into being, uncaused, out of absolutely nothing. My colleague Quentin Smith, who is an atheist philosopher, says that the best explanation of the origin of the universe is that the universe came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. Sort of a good Gettysburg Address of Atheism conclusion, I think. But to me, that's worse than magic. I mean, in magic, when the magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat, at least you've got the hat and you've got the magician. But in this case, the universe is just supposed to have popped into being out of absolutely nothing, which is surely metaphysically absurd.
For more resources on these and many other topics from Dr. William Lane Craig, visit online to reasonablefaith.com. That's reasonablefaith.com.